Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Bluebird Seasons, Witnessing Climate Change in My Piece of the Wild, by Mary Taylor Young. Narrated by Carolyn Jania. Only that day dawns to which we are awake. There is more day to dawn. The sun is but a morning star. Henry David Thoreau. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect. Aldo Leopold, A Sand County Almanac, 1949. Preface. Call me by my name. I began work on a version of this book more than 10 years ago, intending a lyrical nature memoir about my family's years among the forests, mountains, and meadows of southern Colorado. I planned to base that early incarnation, A Bluebird Season, on the nature journal we have kept since autumn 1995, when we first purchased our land in the foothills of the Sangre de Cristo Range in the southern Rocky Mountains. Our experiences keeping a trail of bluebird nest boxes would be the centerpiece, a way to reveal the joys and spiritual renewal we found in nature from intimately watching one piece of land over many seasons and many years. Over time, though, my sweet and simple story grew more serious. We had observed and delighted in the natural rhythms of the land for 2 decades, renewed and reassured by them. But there were more profound changes already underway on the earth and in the skies. I realized our journal, when looked at over the long term, reflected many of these changes, not just seasonal or cyclical variations, like dry years followed by rainy ones, but also deeper and long-lasting differences. The more I thought about the alterations we were seeing, the more evident it became we were witnesses to the growing effects of climate change. This was serious stuff. Long-term drought, increased wildfires, die-off of pinyon forests, extremes of weather, the gradual disappearance of once common birds, and arrival of more south-ranging species. I could no longer proceed with my gentle memoir of our life among the bluebirds with any authenticity or integrity. As often happens with writing, the story had emerged that needed to be told, and it was shouting at me louder and louder, "Call me by my name." With new eyes, I studied our journal from 25 years on the land. Embedded in the entries was the evidence. The journal was more than just a nice record of sightings, of species, of weather and happenings. It was a chronicle of climate change. And it was happening not far away in an Indonesian rainforest or Antarctic ice sheet, but much closer to home. Here, in our piece of the wild. And so the simple story of A Bluebird Season became Bluebird Seasons, a testament to a world that had altered and was still altering. The stories of finding joy and renewal in nature are still the fabric of my tale, but they are tempered by the warning of environmental upheaval that is no longer on the horizon, but right here and right now. Climate change is part of everyone's daily life. It's evident in all our backyards, in everyone's piece of the wild, in winter days much warmer than they should be, in record high temperatures, day after week after month, in spring flowers coming up in January, in birds that should have migrated a month ago, or new species showing up at the feeder and staying to nest. In the parched grass and trees and landscaping from rains that haven't come, or in unprecedented rains and devastating floods. in the skeletal trees long hidden below the waters of the local reservoir, now standing bare and exposed, or in shorelines lost to rising seas. I hope my story will prompt listeners to look around their own backyards, their own pieces of the wild, then call what is happening by its name. This book is the story of past bluebird seasons. The tale of future seasons waits to be written. The thing about seasons is that their ultimate dynamic is change. Birth, growth, death, renewal. There are a variety of possible endings to the story. Different paths we as a global village can choose to take. We can keep the seasons turning, past loss, to renewal. In that lies our hope. Introduction. This is not a matter of Chicken Little telling us the sky is falling. The scientific evidence is telling us we have a problem, a serious problem. Senator John H. Chafee, Republican, Rhode Island, June 1986. Remarks from the U.S. Senate Committee on the Environment and Public Works hearings on ozone depletion, the greenhouse effect, and climate change. We have broken our covenant with the natural world. We have failed as stewards of the place that sustains us. That is the real cause of climate change. Wealthy countries bear the brunt of the blame, but given a chance, people everywhere will exploit Earth's resources if it means a better life. It's only human. We are driven biologically to survive and succeed the best way we can. And we're not very good at balancing that drive with maintaining a healthy, sustainable ecosystem. We have difficulty seeing the big picture of how we're hurting the forest when we're busy with the trees. We don't notice that we are sitting on the tree limb we are sawing off. 25 years ago, I wrote a book called Land of Grass and Sky, A Naturalist's Prairie Journey, in which I said the environmental catastrophe of the 1930s known as the Dust Bowl happened not because of a drought. There had been worse droughts before and since, but because the people farming the Great Plains broke their covenant with the land. Instead of being stewards who listened to the land and worked it sustainably within its rules, they became plunderers. The same is true today, but our broken covenant is with the entire planet. By heating the atmosphere through the release of massive amounts of carbon, we're causing catastrophic changes in the natural systems of Earth that have a real risk of making it uninhabitable for ourselves and for many of the life forms, plants, animals, microorganisms, with which we share this spinning globe. This thing we have wrought, this thing called climate change, is the largest single threat to the survival of the world as we know it. I have devoted my professional life to environmental conservation. Over 30-plus years as a nature and wildlife writer, I've tried to touch minds with intriguing information, and more important, to touch hearts by sharing the delight and wonder I find in nature. I've written with humor and emotion to persuade people to support environmental conservation, to put their voices and their donations and their votes to preserving the natural world we all share. The threats to the environment I've been writing about for decades, species decline, habitat loss, pollution, pesticides, urban and suburban expansion, haven't gone away. But warnings of a greater, even more challenging threat have gotten louder and louder until they are deafening. Earth's temperature is rising. Scientists warn us. At first, this phenomenon was called global warming, but that term confused people. If things were warmer, Why were we having unprecedented snowstorms and weird events like bomb cyclone blizzards? Climate change was a better term. As early as 1986, Congress began investigating this threat. Through the 1990s, climatologists and scientists of many disciplines increasingly warned us that climate change is real and that it's serious, folks. But we weren't really listening. Global warming remained the subject of jokes on late-night television. We all kept buying gas-powered cars, cranking the heat or the air conditioning to keep ourselves comfy, and listening to naysayers with self-serving agendas. Climate change didn't really break into the broad public consciousness until Vice President Al Gore's 2006 film, An Inconvenient Truth, won an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. It also won Best Original Song for I Need to Wake Up by Melissa Etheridge. I bought several copies of the DVD and shared them around, asking only that people watch, then pass the DVD on to someone else or return it for me to give out again. People watched it, or so they told me. A few even shared it. I have no idea whether it changed any minds or stimulated any actions, but at least I had done something. More and more books came out about climate change, including Elizabeth Kolbert's excellent 2016 Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Sixth Extinction, conveying the science, the statistics, the global consequences of climate change. But what I knew from a long career writing about wildlife and conservation is that we all relate to things best through story. Data and science reach the mind, but story reaches the heart. Story shows how science affects the lives of regular people. A story, if it's a good one, grabs our attention and makes us listen. What I have to share with listeners, then, is my story. My climate change story. It's the story of what my family and I see happening at our special place, our piece of the wild in the foothills of the southern Rocky Mountains. This book is not a primer to climate science. I'm not a climatologist, and there are many excellent, detailed, and authoritative sources on climate change. And it doesn't offer magical solutions. In the way of all great stories, ours stands in for the stories taking place in one way or another in the lives of everyone. The things happening on our land and touching us are happening also in the lives and backyards and special places of real people everywhere. And what we all want is for our climate change stories to have happy endings. 1. Bluebirds in the Meadow. 1995 is the hottest year on record since global temperature records started being kept in 1856. British Meteorological Office and the University of East Anglia. The balance of evidence suggests a discernible human influence on global climate. 1995 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Second Assessment Report. August 1995. We move through the meadow, dodging patches of prickly pear cactus, the seed heads of blue grama grass, curved like eyelashes, brush my jeans with a gentle whish, whish. Grasshoppers on spring-loaded legs erupt from the meadow at odd angles ahead of us, spreading their pale-edged wings like dark cloaks. With our approach, lesser goldfinches flutter from the seed heads of woolly mullein, whose spear-like stalks stand in ranks across the meadow, as if left by some ancient warrior legion. The spicy scent of sagebrush follows us like a faithful dog. My husband, Rick, kicks at a pile of elk scat, then turns and smiles at me. Elk poop, I know he is thinking, could be the dealmaker. He has made the point more than once that I am the only person he knows who gets excited over animal droppings. And I am excited. Where there is scat, there are elk. Their antlered shapes likely fill this meadow in fall and winter. The half-ton bulls sparring antler to antler, competing for females who drift between attractive bulls to choose the bull they will mate with, rather than the other way around. Autumn evenings here would be punctuated by the shrill bugling of the bulls, eerie, hollow shrieks that seem oddly high-pitched coming from such large beasts. I had convinced Rick to come on this late summer Sunday outing to look at land with me. Married the previous March, we were drawn to each other by our mutual love of wild places and wild things. I often describe Rick as Mr. Outdoors. He had run the outdoor program at the YMCA's Snow Mountain Ranch near Granby, Colorado, hiking, climbing, and exploring throughout the mountains. He has reached the summits of all 54 Colorado 14ers, mountains rising to 14,000 feet or more in elevation. I am a zoologist and professional nature writer who has hiked, camped, backpacked, birded, climbed, and explored Colorado my whole life. My entire being is committed to the natural communities of my state and the American West. As a kid, I'd never had a permanent home, but Colorado had been my anchor. I had grown up as an army brat, moving 10 times by the age of 17. Between all our relocations and school changes, we'd come every summer to my grandparents' log cabin in Estes Park, Colorado, on the eastern border of Rocky Mountain National Park. My childhood summers spent running wild on the mountain, with hummingbirds whistling around my head and mountain bluebirds flitting across the meadow like scraps of the sky, had determined the course of my adult life. Through all those childhood moves, Colorado was my pole star, the place I could come to every summer, the place I felt most at home. I will make my life here, I decided as a kid. And I did. I enrolled at Colorado State University, earned a degree in zoology, and made a career as a wildlife and nature writer. Though the family cabin in Estes Park was long gone, I was determined to buy land as an adult and create a similar refuge to be close to the wild. Rick also had a special childhood place that was a part of him. He'd spent his boyhood summers at his grandparents' cottage on one of the Finger Lakes in upstate New York, swimming in the icy waters of Skinny Atlas Lake and exploring the steep hillsides above the water. So it wasn't hard to convince him we should create a place like that for us. A weekend retreat far from the city where the landscape and wild things would renew our spirits. Where a child could run wild, get dirty, scrape knees, climb mountains, chase chipmunks. Land in the central Rocky Mountains west of Denver, close to ski resorts and glamour gulches for the rich and famous, was much too expensive for regular folks like us. Then I saw an ad in the Sunday paper for land in southern Colorado. The price per acre was reasonable. So south we drove, to western Los Animas County. We've spent the day exploring land for sale and have narrowed our choices to two parcels. Rick likes this 37-acre piece of land among the rugged foothills west of Trinidad, only about 7 miles north of the New Mexico state line. Broken by rock-tumbled canyons and streaked by arroyos that lie bone-dry most of the year, but rage like angry bobcats when rain falls. It is a land of grassy meadows ringed by blue-green junipers and pinyon pines. The landscape feels more like the American Southwest than it does the Rocky Mountains. This plant community known as pinyon juniper, or PJ, is nicknamed the Pygmy Forest because the trees rarely grow taller than 40 feet. Low stature notwithstanding, these trees will bear rich crops of pinyon nuts and juniper berries and support legions of insects. all providing rich food for the birds and animals that mean so much to me, which are the basis of my career as a nature writer. In areas where there is more water, ponderosa pines tower above the landscape. But I wanted land in the high mountains, cloud-brushing, ethereal acreage of high peaks that might have snow well into summer. This morning I fell in love with a 35-acre lot on top of a mountain, with a view to the west of the high peaks of the Sangre de Cristo range, the Blood of Christ Mountains, and to the northeast, rising from the prairie in the morning sun, a view of the twin mounds of the Spanish Peaks, known to the Utes as Wahatoya, the breasts of the earth. I pictured myself riding away on that mountaintop, its slopes tinged blue by a forest of white firs, with needles as soft and round-tipped as the wing feathers of an owl. Now I stand in the meadow of the lower elevation land and turn a slow 360 degrees. The view is to the east, where the sun will be born each morning behind the long, flat expanse of Raton Mesa. Clouds skiff above the mesa in an impossibly blue sky, and I have a sense that I could surrender myself to their elegant promenade and there would be no passage of time, only these castles of water vapor carrying me with them. From the creek that carves Long Canyon a half mile to the east, the land sweeps gently up Toro Canyon to the summit of Montenegro, Black Mountain, rising to 7,200 feet behind us. The tubby shapes of Colorado pinyon pines, as wide as they are tall, ring the meadow, mixed with the drooping, silvery branches of Rocky Mountain juniper and the stiff, yellow-green of one-seed juniper. Peering over them, like NBA players standing among ordinary mortals, are stately ponderosa pines. The flight of birds across the meadow draws my attention, as it always does. A flash of blue in the sunshine. A cloud of bluebirds, I realize, sparkling across the meadow. Not sky blue mountain bluebirds, but birds that gleam purple-blue in the sun. "Western bluebirds," I say to Rick, not taking my eyes from the birds. I raise my binoculars, track them as they alight like blue ornaments on the shrubby pinyons and mullein stalks. One bird flies suddenly upward, then stops in midair, helicoptering above the grass, tail dropped, wings rowing frantically forward and back, it hangs poised in one spot for impossible seconds. Then, like a stooping falcon, the bluebird drops to the grass, stabs at something with its bill. Then it is airborne again, the sage-green legs of a grasshopper projecting stiffly from its beak. I wonder vaguely if it is one of the hoppers we had flushed, sent by our passage into the beak of death. The bluebird lands on the branch of a nearby pinyon, next to an awkward-looking bluish bird with a speckled breast. Like their thrush family cousin, the robin, the young of bluebirds have speckled breasts. This is a newly fledged bluebird from a clutch laid late in the season, out of the nest but not ready for prime time. The baby is the size of the adult, but its fluffy shape and take-care-of-me posture are undeniably those of a young bird. It doesn't yet understand that with its flight from the nest, the world has taken an immense turn, and Mom and Dad will not bring home the groceries much longer. The baby opens wide its yellow bill, and the adult pokes the grasshopper into the gape. Gulp! Immediately, the yellow bill flares wide again. "Feed me, Papa!" Off the adult goes, back to the store, then back home with an insect. Gulp! The bill yawns wide again, the yellow-rimmed gape a visual demand the adult bird is compelled by instinct to fulfill. After the fourth feeding, the adult flies off and does not return. The baby sits, waiting, trying perhaps to grasp this turn of events. The great world spread before it. Plenty of food hopping around the grass, but no adult to catch it and deliver. The adult's continued absence seems a clear message. Get a job, son. I almost imagine a tear forming in the corner of the fledgling's eye. We all know it's hell to grow up. Finally, the baby launches and flies off after the parent. I look at Rick. He is smiling. He knows he has me. That I will let dreams of the mountaintop go and choose this place. The bluebirds have gone to bat for his team, and they've hit one out of the park. Cabin Journal, October 1995. An enormous group of pinion jays blows in from the southwest. A boisterous blue posse. Easily 100 birds, maybe 300 or more. The pinion jays tumble across our big meadow in a milling crowd, landing on the ground and in the pines, foraging, calling to each other. Some hop around and check out our new fire ring. There is nothing shy or tentative about this crew. They are like a group of Hell's Angels, shouting. Gunning motorcycle engines, descending on a small town saloon in loud and raucous disorder, heedless of the other patrons. They usurp all the stools, pound on the bar. The smaller birds, wary of these rowdy intruders, flee for quieter perches. But the rowdies don't stay long. After pausing in the pinyons to pry what nuts remain from the cones, they head out again in a straggling flock. They're back in the air, on their bikes. Heading out of town in a confused milling riot to more fertile pickings. We hear them calling back and forth in their three-tone nasal mewing that drops in pitch. Mew! Mew! They surge in a loose confederation across the lower meadow and over the ponderosas to the far ridge. Then beyond, their mewing fading, fading until they are gone. I've gone all Thoreau. Hunched over a small notebook with a rigid dark green cover, brushing away the pine needles the breeze drops on my page. It's not a proper nature journal, no tooled leather cover, heavy vellum paper, or brass clasp. Just something I grabbed at the last minute as we headed out to camp on our new land. But it will do. This is our third camping trip since we purchased in August. We set up our little backpack tent in a flat, grassy spot sheltered by ponderosas, with a view of our small pond and Raton Mesa beyond. We've brought the luxury of lawn chairs and a camp stovetop espresso maker. I doubt Henry David had either of those when he lived at Walden Pond. But I'm entitled to a few indulgences. Our first few visits, I'd scribbled notes and sightings on scrap paper, recording our observations more as an afterthought, really. Outshone by the first excitements of discovery as we explore this new place. These first records are Spartan lists of species. Birds. Western bluebird, mountain bluebird, pygmy nuthatch, black-capped chickadee, mountain chickadee, common raven, scrub jay, plain titmouse, sandhill crane in flight, pine siskin, lesser goldfinch, northern mockingbird, mallard, common nighthawk, wild turkey. Mammals. Mule deer. Sightings, scat, bones, antlers. Elk. Sightings, scat. Black bear. Lots of scat. Bear rub tree with coarse black hairs and sap. Mountain lion. Tracks in mud of runoff, seasonal stream after rain. Coyotes. Scat. Lots of evening and night howling. Rocks.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?